Today's guest says while we have made progress through iconic movements such as the civil rights and women's liberation, we still have a long way to go. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and I'm delighted to introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Janice Ellis. Dr. Ellis is described as a native daughter of Mississippi. Dr. Ellis grew up and came of age during the height of the civil rights movement and the women's liberation movement. Born and reared on a small cotton farm, she was influenced by two converging forces that would set the course of her life. Today, Dr. Ellis is the author of many columns and recently her book, From Liberty to Magnolia, In Search of the American Dream. Welcome, Dr. Ellis.
Thank you. Thank you, Pamela. And please call me Janice. Thank you so much.
I shall. Now, you just heard me talk about the converging forces that would set the course of your life. Talk about those converging forces for a moment, if you will.
Yes. The civil rights movement and the women's liberation movement. As you might imagine, growing up on a small cotton farm in Mississippi during the 60s and the 70s, when segregation was king there, it was a very tough time for blacks. And that was the environment in which I started my life, on my dad's farm. And then, of course, brewing was the women's liberation movement. So as a black and as a woman, I was caught and influenced by both of them. I often say that if the civil rights movement was within the walls of my home, then the liberation movement, the women's liberation movement, was in our front yard. And I grew up at a time when, unfortunately, the Klan was very active. My father was an NAACP member. He was working in the 60s to help register people to vote. And it was kind of a life of fear, but at the same time, I just kind of refused to be deterred. And early in my life, of course, the civil rights movement was dominant.
You know, I ask you to say a little bit more about what the experience was of growing up with fear. There are so many people, particularly people of color nowadays, who don't really have a sense of what that was like, don't really have an understanding of, quite frankly, it was dangerous to be a member of the NAACP during those times. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yes. For example, my dad's farm, a little white frame house, three-bedroom house, one room for my mom and dad, one room for the three girls, and one room for the four boys. Well, we grew up between two iconic cities in Mississippi, Liberty and Magnolia. But they did not represent what those iconic names mean. And just let me give you a couple examples. On Saturdays, my mom and I and my dad, often they took me because I was the girl. You know, they don't leave girls at home on the farm to be exposed to the corn-fed little boys and so on. So I had to go into town with my mom and dad. And just let me give you a couple of examples.
Great.
One Saturday, we were in town, and my mom and my dad went to the cleaners, the dry cleaners, just to pick up a dress for her to wear to church on Sunday. And as they came out, two little white boys spat at them, just spitting at them. And my parents were so fearful, they just rushed to the car. They did not say anything to the boys or anything. And I witnessed that. One other time when I was in town with them, I went to the little five and dime store. My mom had sent me in there to buy something. And I handed the cashier the money to pay for the item. She took the money out of my hand, but when she gave me the change, I handed my hand to her for the change, and she slams it on the counter. And I thought, my. So I was just, I don't know if I were more hurt or angry. So I go back to my car, to my mom's car, and I said, Mother, can I have a quarter so I can go buy me a nickel's worth of bubble gum? And she said, bubble gum? You don't chew bubble gum, because really, we were so poor, we didn't get a lot of stuff, you know, candies. I have great teeth because I didn't have a lot of sugar in candy. So I go back into the store, and I get the bubble gum, and the cashier hands, you know, extends her hand to get the money. So I put it on the counter. She peers at me. I peer back at her, and with a kind of like half smile, and she gives me the change, and I didn't hand my hand back for the change. She puts the change on the counter. I go back to the car, and my mom said, huh, she said, gosh, you went back to get bubblegum. And I explained to her what had happened before. Do you know my mom was so upset at me, not the cashier, because she was fearful of what could happen to me because I went back and, in her eyes, challenged the cashier. And then let me just give you one other example.
Okay.
On the Liberty Magnolia Road, my dad's farm was on the gravel portion of the road. I even said the road between Liberty and Magnolia was segregated. Part of the road was paved. And, of course, that section of the road, you had beautiful antebellum homes, whether they were brick or framed. And then on the gravel section of the road, you had little houses, some painted, some not painted. They were wooden framed, some well-kept, some not. And so, but my dad and my mom, our farm, thank God they owned their own land, but our farm was on the gravel portion of the road. But one day, a cow had gotten out of a fence of one of the white neighbors down the road, and you saw a black neighbor and a white neighbor trying to get the cow back into the fence and fix the road, and fix the fence, I'm sorry. And what would you guess? A little five-year-old blonde, cute little white boy yells out, nigger. You know, it was just those things, those little things every day that you could encounter. But probably the worst thing of all was, in terms of fear, my dad was a member of the NAACP. He helped to register people to vote, and the Klan burned crosses on our lawn, not once, not twice, three times. The church that I grew up in and was baptized in was about a block away from my dad's farm. The Klan burned a cross at the church because the church held community organizing meetings. And so my mom had to get my brothers up at night when my dad came home from his $40 a week factory job, had to get them up at night at 11 o'clock to go to the road to wait for my father so that no harm would come to him. Now, that sounds bad, but what's worse is that my high school classmate, Herbert Lee, I don't know, I'm sure many of your listeners might remember the Freedom Riders documentary that was done maybe in 2011 and was really played a lot on HBO and PBS. And it featured a segment on Herbert Lee. Herbert Lee was with my dad and was very active in registering blacks to vote. And his son and I were classmates. Well, one day, Herbert Lee took a bale of cotton to the gin, a cotton gin, in Liberty, Mississippi, and got into a confrontation with the Mississippi legislator who shot him, killed him. And the legislator was never brought to justice. And so those were just some of the incidents right around me growing up. And I'm sorry to say that you know, the lynchings and hangings were real. The castrations were real. When I grew up in the 60s, I'm sure you recall that Mega Evers was assassinated in 1963, 80 miles north of my home in Jackson. You had James Meredith immigrating the University of Mississippi in the 60s. So that was kind of the milieu in which and the environment in which I grew up. And my parents were, you know, they were just very cautious. And let me just say one other thing. When my mom, they were so cautious about what we said and did that it was kind of ever present. And my final example is this. One day, I met the mailman to get stamps. And so I was 11th grade, and he said, "Well, you're getting out of high school. What are you going to do with yourself?" And I said, "I'm going to college." And he said, "College?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Where?" I said, "Tougaloo College." And his expression just changed. And at the moment, I didn't realize why. So the next day, we get a package. The mailman brings the package to the house. Our farmhouse was about two city blocks from the Magnolia Liberty Road. So in our mailbox was at the end of where our road to our house and the main road, the Liberty Magnolia Road intersected. So the mailbox was there. I met him the day before to get the stamps. So he couldn't get the package into the mailbox the next day. So he brings it to the house. And he was very cool to my mom. So my mom says, "Huh, that's strange. Mr. Coltier was very strange today. He didn't have much to say." I said, "Huh." I said, "Yesterday he was asking me all about what I was going to do with myself and what I was going to do after high school. And I told him I was going to college. And he asked me where. And I told him Tougaloo." My mom freaked out. She said, "You told him what?" I said, "Mom, I told him I was going to Tougaloo." She said, "Girl, that school is the school that's raising all those demonstrations in Jackson, Mississippi. Oh, God, you're going to make it hard for me and your daddy to get, seed and stuff on credit in the city." And in the book, I describe how people of color, blacks, you know, if you said anything or anything that whites in the South thought was untoward, of course, you were considered the uppity N-word. Mm-hmm. And I don't say N-word in the book. I just say what mm-hmm. we were considered to be. But that was the kind of environment in which I grew up and became aware in my pre-adolescent years.
So what you're describing is an experience where it sounds like 24/7 you had to be concerned about the safety of yourself, of your family. It almost sounds like there was no safe place. However, you do add in your book, and I'm quoting you now, "Despite the racist, oppressive, and foreboding culture of Liberty and Magnolia, some blacks were able to create some semblance of freedom and sweetness in their private spaces along the countryside." How did your family do that?
Primarily because we owned our own land.
I see.
You know, during my life growing up, as tough as it sounds, my dad probably never would have been an NAACP member, probably never would have been able to register people to vote had he been a sharecropper or rented land from another white landowner, okay? So as long as we, you know, my dad was self-sufficient. He had seven kids, and we grew everything. We, you know, I have a large garden today because that's how I grew up. We grew everything. We grew all the veggies we ate. We grew chickens, cows, pigs, and we were poor. We were poor by any stretch of the imagination, except we owned our own land, and that gave us some sense of independence and freedom. And in the book I described how one day someone came up, a white man was looking for the Chambers, Mrs. Chambers' place, which was really about a mile or two, a mile and a half maybe, from my dad's little farm. And he said he was looking for the Chambers' place. And my dad said, no, sir, this is not the Chambers' place. I'm Stafford Scott. This is my place. Miss Chambers' place is a little ways up the road. And he and I'm a child. And at the point, I didn't recognize this. This is in retrospect. At the time, I didn't recognize the importance of this. And the stranger who had come up on my dad's lawn said, I didn't know Negras, N-I-G-R-A-S, mm-hmm. own land in these parts. And so, that was the thing that helped me. I look back, and as poor as we were, I maybe have gotten a new dress during the revival meeting in August, or occasionally if there was some special event at school. But we were rich in the sense that my dad and my mom had some sense of independence. There were a lot of kids in the surrounding neighborhoods who also worked, you know, the lands of large white farmers, whether it was nearby in Magnolia Liberty or in the Delta area. And my dad he grew his own cotton and his own corn, and so therefore we had to work. We still were working the fields, but we were working his fields.
Right. So it really does speak to the power of owning your own.
The power of owning your own. Yes, it does. Even though my parents were not formally educated, my dad finished the eighth grade. My mom finished high school and a little college before she got married and had the seven of us kids. But they owned their own land, and it was ingrained in them. My grandfather was a descendant of slaves. As was my grandmother, but my grandmother on my dad's side is mulatto. My great-grandfather is white. So he bequeathed her, I guess, 40 acres, and then my grandfather had the wherewithal and the sense to try to acquire. It took him years to pay for another, you know, 40 or 50 acres that were adjacent to the property that they had. But yes, that made the difference in terms of what you were free to do. Herbert Lee, for example, Herbert Lee Sr., who really was the voice behind registering blacks to vote in the Liberty Magnolia area, he owned his own land too. And I would venture to say that the people he recruited to help him were not people who lived or own or rented from any, you know, white land owners in the area.
It speaks to the importance of ownership. It speaks to the importance of community and being able to having the courage to act on what was truly a shared voice. Janice Ellis, author of From Liberty to Magnolia, In Search of the American Dream. We'll be back in just a moment, folks. Janice Ellis, tell us about the impact of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Eric Severide.
Well, when I was about 13 or so, we got our first television. And each evening when I would get home from school, my mom would be watching, or we would, you know, sit together and watch the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. So, and I thought, I mean, it was just routine. It was a thing. It was an event for us. And so, when John Kennedy was assassinated, Eric Severide came on as a guest commentator to put that horrendous day in perspective. And we had gotten the news when I was at school during the lunch hour. And I remember sobbing because knowing what my dad and Mr. Lee were trying to do and the other members in the community were trying to do, I just knew. I knew instinctively that Kennedy, who was a fresh, forward-thinking voice, I knew somehow there was some connection. But Eric Severide that evening explained what a tragic event it was, and so I thought, my gosh, that was helpful. That was calming for me. And then in 1964, in January, Severide joined Walter Cronkite and the CBS Evening News as a regular commentator. And my mom and I, after I did this, you know, in the country you have breakfast, dinner, which is lunch, and supper, which is dinner for us. So, you know, each evening after school, after I did the dishes, 5:30, we would sit in front of that little one television, and she and I would watch the news. And I remember after months, I said, you know, Mom, someday I'm going to do what Severide does. She looked at me and she said, you're not going to do that. You don't see any Negroes or women doing what Severide does. And I just kind of, I looked at her. And I didn't say anything. You know, back then, you didn't sass your parents. And you didn't talk back to your parents. And so I didn't say a word. I just sort of looked at her. But it left a lasting impression on me. And so as I finished school, high school, my mom also made it clear to me. She said, you can make all the A's in the world. I would make A's. I made a B, maybe one or two in high school, because I couldn't pick cotton because I had such a morbid fear of worms, and I still do, caterpillars. Somebody asked me, how do you do a garden and you're so fearful of caterpillars? But I do. But I couldn't pick cotton. I could hoe it, I could scrape it, I could do everything but pick cotton. So I delved into books because I felt like I needed to make my parents proud about something. But my mom would get so upset at me when I'd come back, I'd get a B on something, a paper or something, and I would be just distraught. And so she would say, look, you can make all the A's and B's in the world, but you're not, you know, we can't afford to send you to college. We just will not take a loan. You go to college, get pregnant, get married, and we're stuck with the loan. And that was her mantra. And so, but through all of that, when I was going to high school, I thought, okay, if I just make great grades and maybe I can do something. She doesn't believe I can do what Severide does, and I don't know how Severide does it, but I'm going to figure it out. And that really sort of stuck with me. That was the underpinning of me trying to go on and on and do something to make a difference, because I thought the role he played was so important in public policy and in shaping the events of the world and how they eventually, you know, come back to our daily lives, and we need to pay attention. And so he was probably the first person who really set me on a course to writing commentary.
And fast forwarding, there was a day when you actually were invited to Mr. Severide's home. How'd that happen?
Oh gosh. Well, fast forward, I went to the University of Wisconsin to do my graduate study and to get my PhD. And in the process, I stumbled into Walter Lippmann, who was really the foremost columnist of the 21st century when it came to newspapers and so on. And long story short, I talk about in the book the trials and tribulations I had in graduate school back then because I was the only African American in my department working on a PhD, and I was discouraged by the professors there when I was also a mother. I went to graduate school 6 months pregnant, alone, and I had my baby, had my labor pains in class. It was a tough time, but I left graduate school with all my coursework for my doctorate, two masters. The second I had stumbled into because I thought, if I'm going to do what Severide does, I need to fully understand the political process. I need to understand political socialization. I need to understand how do you shape public opinion. So I kept taking courses in political science. And one day a classmate said to me, "Are you getting your PhD in political science?" I said, "No." He said, "You're not?" I said, "No." He said, Are you getting a master's? Did you get your master's?" I said, "No." He said, "You have been in every class that I have been in. And I received my master's last semester. You need to go talk to the dean." I went to the dean of the political science department at the University of Wisconsin, and they looked at my transcript, and they awarded the degree right then because I had more than completed the requirements for a master's in political science.
Well, now let me ask you a question about the University of Minnesota, because clearly you were
Wisconsin.
I'm sorry, the University of Wisconsin, because clearly you were a little girl from Mississippi, and when you let some of your peers know that, they wanted to know how you got to school with no shoes. So, so given that you didn't have shoes to get to school in Mississippi, how did you get to Wisconsin?
Isn't that just, and this is where stereotypes come into play.
Absolutely.
I was at the University of Wisconsin, and there were three other women, white women, one from New York, and I don't recall where the other ones were from, but the one from New York met me, and she said, "Oh, where are you from?" I said, "Mississippi." And she said, "How did you get here?" She said, "Oh, my gosh." She said, "That's a really terrible place for blacks. Do black kids wear shoes there? And it's so poor. It's such a poor state." And I just looked at her. I didn't answer the question. I said, "I'm a Danforth and Ford Fellow. I have fellowships here for graduate school." But that was the atmosphere in which I entered the University of Wisconsin. You had people thinking that if I were black, how did I get there? Well, when I went to Millsaps, I helped integrate Millsaps College. After King was assassinated, I thought, I have to do something. So I went to one of the best academic schools, and still rated as such, private schools in Mississippi, Millsaps College, predominantly white, and that's where I received my bachelor's. And at the school, I had a professor who was a communications professor who said to me, "You know, Janice, you have a way of analyzing things, and maybe you should, develop your speeches around race relations and how they've impacted your family and the community and what's going on in America." And that's what I did. And so in my senior year, well, my junior year, I was a math major going into Millsaps College. I need to tell you that, until I met a professor who wouldn't even look at me when I was trying to prove an abstract theorem in abstract algebra. But the speech professor, on the other hand, said, "You know, you can apply your analytical skills in other places to help mankind. And if you really are interested in getting a graduate degree in communications, I'll research the best graduate schools in the country, and you can consider whether or not you're interested in going." And that's what he did. the University of Wisconsin, Princeton, and Yale. He said those are the top three in that order for that discipline. You know, schools are ranked for, you know, their right. excellence in certain disciplines. And the University of Wisconsin at the time had the best communications department for graduate study. And so I go to the University of Wisconsin, 6 months pregnant, mind you, alone. And my husband, my ex-husband, had promised me that he'd go with me, but he did not. And that's another story. I talk about that for women who have to just be strong and keep on going. But at any rate, I get to the school, and I'm one of four women in the graduate school working on a PhD. And the one that I'm having a conversation with tells me she can't imagine how I get there because women and, you know, kids in Mississippi, she thought they didn't have shoes. And I didn't answer the question. I just told her how I got there. I said, I got here because I applied and my grades were so good. I was a Danforth Fellow and a Ford Fellow, and all of my expenses were paid except living conditions, and I was a teaching assistant to teach the basic courses in communications at the University of Wisconsin. And that's how I answered the question. But that was the milieu in which, that was the environment in which I studied. And then I had two professors, one of which told me there was no way I could get my PhD or pregnant. He said, you can't have, he said, my wife, Jo Claire, had, you know, her kids, she was working on her master's, and she couldn't even finish her master's. And I thought to myself, that's Jo Claire.
Right, that's exactly.
So, you know, I just looked at him. I didn't say a word. I just looked at him, and I kept going. Yeah, and so that's how I got to the University of Wisconsin, because there was a, and this is the goodness of people, and my book is about the goodness of America. You cannot categorize entire races of people based on the negative experiences of the few. You know, just like the math professor wouldn't look at me because I was black, and you couldn't graduate from Millsaps College unless you took a comprehensive examination in your field. It was my prelude to the prelims of your PhD, as you would know. I had to take a preliminary exam to get out of Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, and there was no way I would get out in mathematics if the chairman of the department would even look at me when I would go in and ask him to help me with the problem. He would take my computations, write red markings and here and there, slide the paper back to me at the end of his desk, never looking up. But my other professor in communications embraced me. He was a white professor from St. Louis, and he saw something in me, and he helped me to get to the University of Wisconsin.
You know,
that's the goodness of America.
Absolutely. It really does speak to the almost urgency of not putting people into boxes based on what you think they think or based on your experiences with a few. Talk to us about the husband that you had at the time. He was really quite awful.
Well, you know, and let me just back up a little bit. You know, growing up in the South, you know, there are cultural norms that I took to heart, you know, and my brother teases me. He said, girl, you were so naive. I took it to heart. My mom would tell me and my sisters, if you go out there and have sex and get pregnant, they're going to throw your father off the deacon seat. He's the deacon in the church, you know. And so I grew up truly believing. My faith has sustained me, and I talk about that in the book. You know, I believed that you need to live a certain way, conduct yourself in a certain way. And so, you know, I valued, and you know, this is just my opinion. I'm not putting it off on anybody or saying anything. But at the time, you know, I was an adolescent girl, and I believe that I needed to do what my parents told me, and I believe I needed to do what I learned in Sunday school. And so I guarded my chastity like you wouldn't believe. And so I thought I had met the man of my dreams. He was brilliant. He was good-looking. He had gone to a school, Ripon College in Wisconsin, graduated with a degree in mathematics. And I happened to have met him when I was at Tougaloo College during the 60s, when King and Stokely Carmichael and Julian Bond and all would come there to organize the demonstrations in Jackson. And so I met him one summer when he was visiting his brother. And I thought he was my reward for living, quote, a very good life, and he would be my prince, and you know, he's my prince. And so he was a brilliant guy, very very good looking, but he was the only man I had really gotten involved with in terms of a serious relationship. And my mama, bless her soul, she's the daughter of a preacher, the wife of a deacon, and in her own way, she tried to tell me, don't settle for the first guy you meet. Get your degree. Get, see the world. Meet people. And she, in her own way, she tried to tell me, you don't have to get married to have sex. I mean, she really tried to tell me that. But she couldn't say that outright. And right. So I'm so naive. I'm just, you know, I didn't pick it up. So I date this guy for a year and a half. He sketches me. He was very talented. Write poetry. He wrote poetry. He would write me these beautiful letters. He came to visit me at college. And we married in 68 in my father's house where I was born. And maybe 2 or 3 months later, this was in 1968, in 1970 I graduated. And so, but maybe 2 or 3 months into the marriage, I saw a change. He was withdrawn. He would go to my parents' home, wouldn't converse. But at the same time, he said to me, I really want to have kids. I don't know if I can have kids. You know, do you want to start a family? I said, sure. I said, but I've also, you know, sent my admission papers to graduate school in Wisconsin. So if I become pregnant, you have to come with me. He said, oh, I will. So I did. I became pregnant. I was admitted to the graduate school, and lo and behold, my dear husband back then signed this contract to teach, continue teaching math at the high school there. And I think he thought that I didn't have the courage to go to Wisconsin 6 months pregnant alone. I got in a little Maverick, my mom standing in the yard sobbing, sorry. And I went to Madison and I started graduate school. And my husband, I took a cab to have my first son. My husband joined me the next summer when he finally decided he would join me. So, you know, and I stayed in that marriage for 8 years trying to salvage it. In the meantime, he went to law school at the university. I had gotten an application for him, encouraged him to go to law school because I thought that would kind of take the pressure. If he thought, you know, I should... why am I getting a PhD and he's not? I thought that would help the marriage, but it didn't. So I left the University of Wisconsin with all my coursework for my PhD. He left with his law degree in hand, and I didn't finish my PhD until a divorce and 7 years later.
You know, you talk about not only the abuse that you experienced at his hand, but then some years later, you found yourself in a relationship with another abusive person. And you certainly go through that in detail in From Liberty to Magnolia. Perhaps one of the greatest takeaways for women is that you can get out and you can survive and you can have your own life. Dr. Ellis, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to really fast forward to what's going on today.
Thank you.
Janice, there's so many remarkable experiences that you talk about in From Liberty to Magnolia. We're not even going to go into the day you walked into the top radio station and said, I think I should have a 2-minute segment. And the first response you got was, well, who the hell are you? Which is really, really kind of could be off-putting to some. But I want to move to sort of the experiences you had as you worked for the mayor. And there was a time when there was a position available that by all rights should have been yours, but was not. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes. I work with the mayor for 8 years. And let me just tell you this. It was one of the best jobs I had to prepare me for everything else that came afterwards. But when I got to the mayor's office, instead of looking at my degrees in communications and political science, he looks at my math courses. I was three courses away from a bachelor's in mathematics when my professor deterred me. So he assigns the city budget to me. I thought, no. He assigns the city budget. And after 2 years of my being the budget person in, on the staff who would work with the department heads with their budget requests each year to get funding. He said to me, he said, Janice, he said, I want you to look at the different emerging budgeting systems and budgeting processes for municipalities and try to come up with ways that we can improve our system. And so I did that. I did research for about a year. And then I told him that I thought, none of the emerging budgeting systems were perfect within themselves, but I thought there were elements from a couple that I thought would work very well for our city. And I thought we could take those and come up with our own system. And it was a combination of performance-based budgeting and zero-based budgeting. And I describe what those are in the book. Well, at any rate, after about a couple of years, I designed the system, and we did a pilot project. At the time, he allowed, once I described to him how it would work and how it could work, I hired two other people to help with the mechanics of getting it implemented in some departments in the city as a pilot, just to test to see how it will work. Well, it worked really well. And after the pilot, the city and the council and the mayor, they adopted as the new budgeting system for the city. And also the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National League of Cities thought it was a great model for cities that were 30,000 population and larger. Well, maybe another year fast forward, the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National League of Cities combined to go to an international symposium in Bonn, Germany. And they asked the mayor if he would present the new budgeting system for Milwaukee as an example of great fiscal management in government. And, of course, he said yes. So one day he calls me into his office, and he says, Janice, I want you to get your passport. We're going to Bonn. Do you have a passport? I said, yes. He said, we're going to Bonn, and I want you to present the system, ADAP, which we called it. Allocation, Decision, Accountability, Performance was the acronym for the system. He said, I want you to go to Germany with me, and you can take one staff person. You pick who you want to take, and then I want you to present. I sat there dumbfounded, and he got up, patted me on the back, and I just got up and walked out with it, speechless. And so fast forward to, this was in 1982. Fast forward to 1984. The budget director retires. And the system I helped to create is fully implemented in every department. It has done well. The mayor has gotten reelected based on the fact that he was more fiscally responsible. And the budget director retires. He calls me into his office and he says, Janice, I know you could do that job with your eyes closed. But if I put a black woman over the purse strings of the city, I will not get reelected. White folks on the South Side will not vote for me, and black folks won't vote at all. I hear those words as if I heard them today, yesterday, as if they were spoken today. And so he then said, but I think you'd be a great, you know, I think I can put you over the tax department. I said, Mayor, I don't know anything about tax property appraisal, and that will be something I would have to learn. He said, you're a quick study. You can pick it up quickly. I said, let me think about it. And so about a week later, I said, Mayor, I think, no. I said, I don't think I will do that. And he said, Janice, and I said, I think I've gone as far as I can go. I said, I really think I've gone. I said, we've had a great working relationship. I think I've gone as far as I can go. And I think I'm just going to pursue other options. And he said to me, oh, you can't, don't leave now, because if you leave now, the paper is going to have a field day. He said, they're going to have a field day. I said, well, Mayor, I can't, that's not my problem. I don't know what to do with that. And sure enough, I resigned. I left, and the paper had a field day. They talked about how a mayor could not promote the woman that he had showcased for the last 2 to 3 years as his doctor. Whenever he has a budget problem, he goes to his doctor, okay? And she and they took him to task with articles and editorials, and I left and was recruited to run a health insurance company.
And in that, you know, it's interesting because with the experiences that you've had, with the professional and educational successes that you've had, it also came with so many other challenges. Before I talk to you for just a second about the healthcare organization, I was amused to some extent when you talked about the mayor who hated the media, especially the Milwaukee Journal. And I think about those days as you describe them. And then I think about today and what seems to be a never-ending feud between our current administration and the press. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about what you're seeing today.
Well, you know, the mayor, the other thing that solidified my desire to write, other than Eric Severide, and I know you asked me about getting to his house, and I probably blew that question. But at any rate, he would go to the editorial page and look at what they were saying about him or his policies and so on. I think the media today, quite honestly, the commentators, do a bit of a disservice, many of them, to the public. Because instead of being providing an objective analysis, both sides of the issue, as to what is going on, they often become the news themselves. They're the zealots. They advocate a side. And forgive me for listing people like, you know, Rush Limbaugh and some of the conservative commentators and some of the liberal commentators. You know, give the public the best objective analysis that you can get. The press is the fourth state in this country. If we can't have an honest, objective press, there are no alternative facts. That is the most gross misnomer, and yet somehow or another it is seeping into our culture and our lexicon. We're beginning to think that facts are changeable. They aren't. Your opinion is changeable, but facts aren't. And so I look at what's happening today, and that's one of the motivators I had in writing my book, finishing my book. One was, we've got to stop with the skin color problem. We've got to stop judging people based on their skin color. And we also have to stop this uncivil discourse. And, you know, we're not going to gain anything. We're not going to get anything, you know. And what the leadership, what the government leadership is doing now to undermine the press, is sad. And the press has to also step up, and let the public know that they are worthy. It's worthy of being trusted by, you know, presenting objective data, not pushing some agenda, whether it's liberal or conservative. Just give the public the right chance to make an informed decision.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. In so many ways, the news is not the news. It's the reporter's personal opinion.
Yes. And they're just talking his, and Walter Lippmann, what I loved about Walter Lippmann, he really codified, he and Severide codified what advocacy journalism is. You know, you have, you know, straight journalism where you report the facts, you know, Bob shot John, but you also have element of journalism that says, well, what were the conditions under which John was shot? You know, what are the social conditions? Analyze those conditions so it will help us move forward as a society. Don't just say, you know, John shot Bob because John is a thug or this. And why is John a thug? You know, why do you label him as such? And we're missing that analysis so much today, Pamela. We are. When there are so many avenues to get to the public, whether it's television, radio, or our iPhones, the internet. I mean, give the public something that they can make a decision. And let me just go back real quickly. We're probably running out of time. But anyway, how I got to Severide, I'd have to share this. I told Severide, I wrote him a letter and told him that I watched him as a child, and I told my mom someday I'd do what Severide did, and I'm still trying. He called me at the mayor's office, and the mayor happened to be in my little cubicle at the time asking me a budget question, and the receptionist comes in the door, and she says, Janice, she comes in the door, and she says, Severide is on the phone, and the mayor jumps up and says, what the hell does Severide want with me? And Florence said, Mayor, he's calling for Janice. And the mayor sits down. He's standing to go out of my office. He sits down, and I'm just panic-stricken. I said, I said, Eric Severide's on the phone. I said, oh, my God. I said, give him a minute. She said, Janice, you can't keep Mr. Severide waiting. So I said, this is Janice Anderson at the time. It was before I married my current husband. And he said, this is Eric Severide. I got your letter, and I would love to invite you here. And he invited me to his home. And I interviewed him for over an hour. And he connected me with James Reston at the New York Times because he was the current, probably most well-known columnist for the Times, New York Times at the time, and Marcus Childs. I quote him in the book. I have a recording of our interview that's never been published, but I've put some of it in the book. But anyway, just to make a long story short, we need to get back to really practicing yes. advocacy journalism. The public doesn't have the wherewithal to be at the policy hearings to know all the facts involved in an issue. But for those of us who can gather those facts for them and present them to them, we should present them in an objective way so they can come to an informed opinion.
And you continue to write today.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question. I'm going to ask you to give us some information about how we can follow the work that you do. But one of the questions that you asked in the book that I'm going to ask you as we close out today is I'm going to ask you the question that you asked of the reader and of yourself. And that is, are you a Black person who happens to be a mm-hmm. woman, or are you a woman who happens to be Black? That is such a question for so many. What's the answer for you?
Oh, gosh. My career spans 40 years, and, you know, there was a time when, whether it was at the pharmaceutical company or the radio stations or anyplace else, I'd walk in, and, of course, I was the only Black thing there. And I over time, I walked in, Pamela, and I thought, okay, now I'm walking in here, and what's the first thing they see? Do they see a Black person, and then, oh, she's a woman, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, I think people see skin color first. I mean, I think that's why I come down, because if you look at the world and the landscape, people of color, I don't care if it's in Brazil, I don't care if it's in India, I don't care if it's in the UK, I don't care where it is. Color, skin color, is a problem. gender also. But I think when you look at the Fortune 500 companies, you have 24 females now. All of them are white. There was one, Ursula Brown at Xerox. She's now moved on. But you have, and I don't know that you have any African Americans now. You had four black males, but I think they've retired. So I had to come down on color because I think on par, maybe women have advanced a little bit more than people of color. So I think my color leaps out first when I walk into a room. And then, you know, I'm a woman. So I walk with both of those burdens, as so many millions of women do, blacks and women. And that's why I wrote the book. I want to say, you know, don't let that define you. Don't let people label you. Know yourself. Know your capabilities. And you just keep walking.
How do people follow the work that you do and learn more about From Liberty to Magnolia?
Well, there's a collection of all my writings, and I put some sample ones in the book that I wrote years ago that are still relevant today at JaniceSEllis.com. There are two categories of columns that I write. One is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the other one is racial and gender inequality. And there's a book, there's a page, Janice S. Ellis, American Dream, that is dedicated to my book. I go on tour starting next week, and I'll be going on tour during the month of February and March. So, but you can learn all about the book and my writings on JaniceSEllis.com.
Janice, I have to thank you so much for the work that you've done for the book and just for you being you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Pamela, for having me, and thank you for caring enough to have me.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so do send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.